This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents Escaping Home by A. American. Read by Duke Fontaine. Prologue. It took weeks to walk home, but I made it. The entire time I was focused on just getting there. I never really gave much thought to what would happen afterward. Even my most pessimistic thoughts of how life would be at home didn't come close to the reality. Now our neighborhood is basically empty. Many have simply disappeared. We are down to our small group now. My family, my neighbors, Danny and Bobby, and Sarge and his gang. Fewer people around means more eyes on us, attention we certainly do not want. In the before, people used to talk about the FEMA camps and whether or not they would ever choose to go into them. In the now, with the harsh light of reality shining on the situation, many of those who said they would never be taken to one of these camps were happy to walk in on their own. We've been the target of raiders and of the federal government, both apparently trying to force us into the camps. Now we must decide whether to stay and fight or find some place to retreat to. Escape may be our only option. We have a place, the perfect place for long-term survival, really. But my family, Mel and the girls, may not be ready for it. While the rest of the country may have fallen apart, our preparations are mitigating the effects they feel. With running water, power, and abundant stored food, at least for now, they see it as an apocalyptic holiday. But there are forces at play, beyond our control, that may bring about this last desperate move. Life in the camps isn't what it appears to be. While there is food, water, and warmth, the price is near slave labor and virtual imprisonment. In the care and custody of FEMA, backed up by the DHS, those inside the camp have no rights, no freedom, and worse yet, are exposed to the possible brutality of their caretakers. Every barrel has a bad apple, and over time, those bad ones start to rot the good ones. Left unchecked, this rot can take over the entire barrel. With so much absolute power over so many helpless souls, horrors are bound to be committed. Among those in the camp is our friend Jess, who walked with Thad and me on our long adventure home. We don't know how she's faring, but with the mixed reports about the camp, one thing is certain. Surviving in the camp may prove far more difficult than the struggle outside. Chapter 1. Every day, when her work detail was over, Jess would try and visit her brother. It was best to stay busy like that, otherwise the memories would return. It was the thoughts of her mother that were the worst. The image of her mother lying in the cold dirt as the light of the flames consumed what little they had in the world, the dark crimson stain on the ground around her, and her father. He'd resisted and was made an example to the others as a result. These images were burned into her mind like an overexposed negative. Thinking back to the raid made her feel nauseous. Everything had happened so quickly. It was late in the evening when a couple of old trucks sped into their little hamlet of cabins. Before anyone could react, the shooting started. Her dad put up a fight even after he was gunned down. Her mother ran to his side, picked up the pistol, and shot one of the raiders, but just after she hit him, she was immediately gunned down. Jess managed to make it into the woods with some of her neighbors, running as fast as her legs could carry her. Waiting as she heard the blood-curdling screams and shots was agonizing. When she returned back to her home, she found the raiders had stripped the place, taking everything they could physically carry away. And to her shock, she found her brother, Mark, lying unconscious on the ground. Jess sat on the ground with her brother's head in her lap, shocked. She tied off the wounds on his arm with her flannel and wrapped a blanket that she had retrieved from one of the smoldering homes around his stomach. but there was nothing else she could do. She spent the night under the old oak trees, cradling her brother in her arms. Sleep never came as she kept checking his pulse, feeling it grow weaker and weaker with each hour. When the sun rose, she was relieved to see big white trucks show up, American flags painted on the sides and the letters FEMA on the doors. The FEMA people immediately set about treating Mark, making him comfortable, bandaging his wounds, and loading him into one of the trucks. He needed more treatment, and they told her that she could go with him to one of their facilities. She gladly climbed aboard. Once she was in the truck, a man in a uniform clipped a form to her shirt, the label DD2745 emblazoned across the top of it. As they were pulling away, she could see others loading her mother and father into body bags. She began to cry. At least they would be buried. Along the way, they stopped at small communities or refugee camps where others joined them on the trucks. Several more wounded were also loaded in beside Mark. All the stories were horrible, though very similar to Jess's experience. The raiders would come in and take what they wanted: food, guns, tools, tents. The worst stories included people disappearing, women and children, mostly. After a few hours, the truck rumbled through a gate and stopped. When the doors opened, Jess shielded her eyes against the midday sun and gazed upon the camp for the first time. Jess climbed down to see rows upon rows of tents filling an area the size of two city blocks. All around her were people in uniforms with guns. While the wounded were carted off to one area of the camp, she and the other healthy refugees were ushered to a large tent. Before entering it, they were subjected to a thorough and invasive search, in which suspect items were tossed on the ground by the guards. Jess's feeling of salvation was fading, being replaced with one of fear. After everyone was processed, they were given food and a beverage that tasted like Gatorade. It was amazing to be eating meatloaf with mashed potatoes, and Jess savored it. As they ate, names were called out, and each person went to a series of tables in the front, where they filled out forms. All sorts of information was collected. The obvious question about name, age, sex, and religion. But also more interesting questions about NRA membership, club memberships, political party affiliation, and whether or not they were on any form of government assistance. Jess filled out the questions without a second thought, and it seemed that the others did too. No one was willing to question the process. The last two stations were the medical station, where they received a very basic physical examination, and a station for a psychological evaluation. Jess answered the questions for the psych evaluation dully, unable to emote the anguish that she felt for her mother and father. Once through the last station, she was free to chat with others in the tent and continue eating her meal, though it was made clear that they were all forbidden to leave. Jess spent her time looking around, observing the disheveled masses that surrounded her. A short time later, a series of names were called, and each person was photographed and issued an ID badge. Jess was given a yellow badge. The little plastic card included her picture, name, social security number, and, once again, the DD2745 ID number that she was given in the truck. Once the badges were issued, an announcement was made for everyone to gather under the flags that matched the color of their badges. This was where the first signs of trouble appeared. Families were separated into different color codes, and people began to protest. The agents in the tent assured everyone it was only a temporary situation and would be resolved shortly. The different colored badges simply meant various kinds of additional steps were needed to secure their status. This satisfied most people, and they quietly went off to sit in their assigned housing areas. Jess sat sipping on her drink, absent-mindedly observing the other people that were being processed. A few feet away from her, a middle-aged man sat giving his name and social security number just as everyone else in the room had. His info was entered into a laptop by a woman in a DHS uniform. She asked him to give her the tag on his shirt, which he did. She tapped away, then asked him some questions, which he answered. She looked back to her screen for a moment, then looked up to one of the armed guards and waved him over. Two of them approached. She showed them something on the screen, and they exchanged words that Jess couldn't make out. The man was getting nervous. "What's the matter?" he asked. They ignored his comment, and then one of the guards told him to stand up and put his hands behind his back.
"What for? I didn't do anything. I came here for help."
One of the guards drew a taser.
"I said, put your hands behind your back. Do it now."
The man leapt from the chair.
"I didn't do anything! I didn't do anything!" he shouted, as he tried to run for the door.
There was a pop, and the man crashed to the ground in front of Jess, writhing and screaming. She jumped from her seat and gasped, shocked at what she had just witnessed. The two guards were instantly on him, pulling his hands back.
"Don't resist, or you'll get it again!"
The man tried to wriggle from the burly officer's grip.
"Hit him again!" the guard shouted.
Jess could hear the clack, clack, clack as the voltage pulsed through the man. The sudden violence scared a number of people in the tent, and they started to get up, trying to get out. Guards wearing gas masks blocked the doors, holding large cans that looked like fire extinguishers under their arm.
"Return to your seats, or you will be pepper sprayed."
Jess knelt down in front of her chair. The man being cuffed was a mere 4 feet from her. She could see his eyes, wide with fear, tears rolling down his cheeks. He was quietly whimpering.
"I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything."
Once he was trussed up, the DHS woman who started it all came up and spoke with one of the guards.
"Here's his paperwork."
"Which list is he on?" the man asked, looking the forms over.
"He came up on a couple. He's subversive by nature."
They grabbed the man by his arms and dragged him out of the tent. Jess slowly got back in her chair, thinking, "What have I gotten myself into?" Once Jess was in her housing unit, a big military-style tent, she listened to the orientation speech given by a red-haired woman in a black uniform who identified herself only as Singer, no first name. The speech covered the security protocols in great detail. It was stressed that the security rules were for their safety, and there was no acceptable excuse for violations. The lecture went on to inform them they would soon be taken to shower. A hot shower, Jessie thought to herself. I can't even remember the last time I had one. And given a uniform. The guard stressed that it was mandatory to always be in uniform with your ID badge plainly visible on the outside of your clothes. And perhaps most important of all, no one was able to leave the camp without express permission of DHS officials. Even portions of the camp itself were not able to be accessed by civilians. The off-limits areas were identified on a large map of the camp. Some areas of the camp were simply marked as cross-hatched areas. Nothing inside these areas was identified. She went on to say that they could use the common area just outside the tent, but could not wander freely around the camp. Again, for their safety. Singer told them to each pick a bunk and get settled. As they were bustling around the room, she informed them that the next day they would get their work assignments, which caused a heated exchange as to why they had to work. Some women were up in arms about it, but just didn't really care. It was something to do other than sit around and worry about her brother. Singer explained that the shifts for different duties would rotate, and while some were still grumbling, for the most part, the ladies settled down. Jess approached Singer as she was headed out the door and asked whether she would be able to go to the infirmary and visit her brother. Singer replied that as long as she did her work, she could go. Jess was relieved to hear that. She was sick with worry over Mark. In the truck, the medical staff had said they assumed he was bleeding inside his skull, but they had neither the facilities nor the personnel to address such injuries. Time was the only medicine they could offer. She decided that she would head over to visit him as soon as she picked her bunk, eager to leave behind the chattering and noise of her many tentmates. It would be nice to get a little privacy after today's activities. even if it only meant walking to see her brother. Jess quickly settled into her new routine at the camp. Each day, she and the others were woken up, put in formation, and given breakfast before being told their work assignments. Sometimes these jobs lasted a day, sometimes several. All the jobs were mindless and boring. Jess often found herself reminiscing about being in her college classes at FSU. Even her most dull ones were more exciting than the tasks she had been assigned so far at the camp. One morning, during breakfast, she began to laugh, something she hadn't done in a long time. A young black girl in front of her in line turned around with a puzzled look on her face. "I'm sorry, but it feels like we're in that movie Groundhog Day. We're doing the same thing over and over," said Jess. The girl laughed and said, "You're so right. Only we don't have Bill Murray here to crack us up. We only have Singer," she said, mimicking the DHS leader's strut. Jess giggled, and the girl offered her hand. "I'm Mary. I think we're in the same tent." "Yeah, I thought I recognized you. We came in the same day. And I'm glad that I'm not the only one getting annoyed by our lovely leader," Jess said. That day, Mary switched to the bunk next to Jess. They became quick friends, relying on each other to listen and for support. They both needed someone to open up to share the weight they carried. Unlike many of the women in the tent, Mary also felt as though the safety and security they hoped the camp would provide was beginning to feel more like a sentence than salvation. It was good to have a friend around, Jess thought. It broke up the monotony of their days. When the shooting started, Jess was on a detail filling sandbags. The sudden long burst of machine gun fire caused everyone to stop and look up. Then several more weapons began to fire in a terrifying fusillade of gunfire. The security detail with the work group screamed for everyone to get on the ground. Three men ran through the group, pushing any slow-moving bodies down before falling into the deep sand with their weapons pointed in the direction of what was now, obviously, a battle of some sort. Jess covered her head as the gunfire crackled around her, a now all-too-familiar sound that caused her to shake uncontrollably. Mary crawled over to her, hugging the ground.
"What's going on?"
Mary asked, fear in her eyes. All Jess could do was lay there with the side of her head pressed into the sand. She was too scared to even speak. The security element's radios were full of shouts and calls. Then the camp siren began its long wail, adding to the din. Just when Jess thought it would never stop, the gunfire ceased. Humvees and ATVs were racing all over the camp as the sound of the siren began to wind down. Shortly after, the security officers jumped to their feet and ordered everyone up. They began herding the work detail back toward the housing area. The camp was a hornet's nest of activity. Once they were back at their tent, they were ordered to lock down, which consisted of sitting on their bunks in silence. To most of the women in the tent, the idea of sitting in silence after witnessing such violence was a joke. As soon as the doors shut, they were all moving around, offering their theories and breaking into their respective cliques. Jess was sitting on her bunk with her arms wrapped around her knees, her face tucked into them. She was trying to calm down, shaken by the memories of the last time she had heard a firefight. Mary leaned over, smiling.
"Hey, girl, it's okay. We're safe now."
Jess forced a smile in return.
"Hey, I counted 27 today. That's the most yet," Mary whispered to Jess.
Mary had been trying to count the number of government personnel working in the camp. It was something to do to pass the time. Until today, she had identified 23.
"I wonder how many people actually work here," Mary asked,
seemingly to the air. Jess knew she was trying to get her to talk, but she just wasn't interested. Mary continued chatting.
"Get this. Apparently, the shooting was from people outside the camp. Rebels."
Outside of the camp? Jess couldn't believe it. Even though her work detail was by the perimeter, and the noise was coming from that direction, the thought of being attacked by outsiders seemed unbelievable. The camp was supposed to be a safe place, and now people were shooting at it? She couldn't take it anymore. Pulling her wool blanket up, she rolled over and closed her eyes. Chapter 2. Since I was in the lead, everyone followed me into my driveway. I drove around the house and stopped outside my workshop. Thad jumped out of the buggy he was in and rushed over to me.
That had to be Jess. It was, wasn't it?
Man, it sure looked like her. It had to be. Sarge was in earshot.
Who? Annie? Was Annie in that camp?
It sure looked like her, Sarge, Thad replied. Why in the hell are you still calling her that anyway? I asked, rolling my eyes at Sarge's nickname for her.
I'll call her whatever I want, the old man snorted. I just wish we could have confirmed whether it was her or not. If them assholes hadn't started shooting, we may have been able to.
The guys all gathered around as a lively discussion about Jess began. Jeff interrupted with,
Wait, who the hell's Jess?
All the guys stopped talking and looked at me expectantly. I gave him the elevator version. How I met her back when all this chaos started. How she wouldn't leave me alone until I agreed to let her walk with me. Thad chimed in about how she and I met him, and how she took to calling him the Black Incredible Hulk. Together we told him about the family we tried to help, and Thad told about the shooting where I was injured. Once Jeff was up to speed, the talk moved back to her being in the camp. Sarge wanted to go get her, but knew it would be foolish to even consider.
How'd she look? Sarge asked.
Thad looked at me, and we both gave a little shrug.
Looked okay to me, I said.
Yeah, she looked all right. She was working, filling sandbags from what I saw, Thad said. Sarge nodded his head.
Well, that's good. Anyone hurts that girl, I'll kill him deader than shit.
While he was stewing, I ducked into the shop.
What the hell are you doing?
He called out as I crawled around under the shelves. Spinning around on my knees, I held up a bottle of whiskey. The old grouch smiled, executed a perfect about-face, and stepped out the door. I followed him out, twisting the top off the bottle as I did. I turned the bottle up and took a long pull on it. After what had just happened at the camp, I needed a drink. We stood around by the shop and passed the bottle. It wasn't long before my daughters, Little Bit and Taylor, came out. They were slightly more at ease around Sarge and his crew now. Sarge saw Little Bit coming toward us and knelt down, holding the bottle out.
Want a sip?
She screwed her face up.
Ew, no, that stuff's gross.
Sarge smiled and looked at me, then back to her.
And how do you know that?
'Cause it's whiskey. I know what that is. Sarge smiled and patted her head as he stood up. Taylor grabbed my arm, laying her head against my arm. I looked over at her and asked if she was okay. She said she was fine, but I know her too well. Something was eating at her. She eventually got up and went into the shop and started to nose around the shelves of supplies. Sarge watched her as she went in, then jerked his head, indicating we should all walk away from the supplies for a bit.
You guys know that after what went down today, that staying here is a bad idea, right?
Sarge said quietly.
Maybe, but they don't know it was us, Danny said.
How many other people around here got wagons like those? Sarge said, pointing to the buggies sitting in front of the shop. You can bet your ass they know who was out there, and they will be coming for us.
What do you think we should do? Thad asked.
It's not what I think. It's what's got to be done. We need to un-ass this place. It's time to go, Sarge said flatly.
Danny and I shared a look. It was obvious to everyone that we weren't on board with the idea.
Look, guys, I agree with him. If we stay here, people are going to die, Mike said.
I agree, Ted added.
I personally don't care what we do, as long as it keeps my ass alive, Jeff said.
I looked at my house and property, then back at Danny. I don't want to leave.
As bad as things are right now, at least my family has their home.
I know you don't. Hell, a lot of people have lost everything recently.
Sarge paused and looked at Thad.
If you want to keep them alive, we need to get them out of here.
You've already got one daughter with a bullet wound, Morg. I know you don't want to see it happen again, Doc said.
How about this, Danny said. We start moving some stuff out to the cabins, pre-positioning some supplies. And if things go south, we can haul ass out of here with the rest of what we may need.
This would be no small feat. The cabins were 17 miles away in the Alexander Run. With only the Suburban and the buggies, it would take several trips and quite a bit of time to get done, which added to the urgency. If Sarge was correct, and they did make a move on us here, we'd never get out with what we needed if we hesitated. Plus, the sooner we started this and had people stationed on the river, the smaller the chance of someone else moving into the cabins. I started to change my mind on the matter. It was agreed that we should start moving some stuff out as a precaution. Reggie said he wanted to take the pigs, which led to a discussion about how to pen them up. He said he had a solar-powered hot wire rig. Sarge said we could use that and pen them up against the creek, using it as a natural barrier. The next issue was how to secure what we took out there. Sarge started going over a head count and how we could split everyone up, but he was forgetting some people.
Don't forget about Mel and the girls, plus Bobby, I said.
Sarge paused for a moment. Can they use weapons?
Bobby can, Danny said.
Mel, Taylor, and Leanne can, I said.
I can too.
We looked back to see Little Bit standing there. Her comment got a giggle out of everyone.
I bet you can, Ted said with a smile, shaking his head.
I can. My daddy taught me.
So, there are 13 of us then. All right, Sarge laughed.
The plan we came up with would send Jeff and Mike out to the cabins. With only two of them, it would be tough to maintain a constant watch, but we hoped that being so far out in the woods would cut down on the number of potential intruders. In addition to keeping an eye on things, they would start on some of the projects we would need in place should we have to bug out. Sarge wanted us to do an inventory of everything we had that could be useful to take. With so many people, it was sure to be a substantial pile of supplies. Sarge said he would take watch down at the barricade, and Thad volunteered to go with him. We all agreed to meet in the morning. Once everyone was gone, I went inside. Mel was just walking out of the bedroom, rubbing the sleep from her face.
When did you get back?
Not long ago. How was your nap?
Good. I feel great.
You hungry?
Of course, I answered, as I headed for the living room to check on Leanne. She was still on the couch, as she had been when I left, listening to music on the iPad and drawing. She looked up as I came in and stretched her arms out, the universal sign for a hug. Sitting down on the edge of the couch, I gave her a hug and she pulled the earbuds out. I asked her how her leg was. She said it was feeling better and asked if she could go outside for a while to take a short walk. Danny had come across a crutch from somewhere, and Leanne was using it to get around. I told her she could, but to be careful and take her sisters with her. She started to hobble toward the back door. With her gone, I went in to talk to Mel about the plan to start moving some supplies out to the cabins. She couldn't remember where the cabins were located, even though we had seen them before when we kayaked down the run.
What are they like?
Primitive.
How primitive?
They're just plywood, really. But they're solid, and will make a decent place should we need to go to them.
Well, I hope we don't have to go to them.
Me too, but it's better safe than sorry. And after what happened today, we may have to.
Why? What'd you guys do?
I'll tell you later, I said, as I headed for the back door. I didn't want to scare her right now. The girls were outside throwing a frisbee around, with Leanne leaning on her crutch, catching the tosses that passed within arm's reach. It was nice to see them hanging out together, actually doing something besides bickering.
I stepped outside and intercepted the frisbee from Little Bit, then threw it, tousling her hair as I continued to the edge of our property. It had been a couple of days since I'd seen my neighbor Howard, which was unusual. I decided to go check on him. The last time I saw him, he didn't look so good. I headed for his place, nervous about what I was going to find. There was no answer to my knock, so I tried again and waited. It was obvious no one was coming, and I couldn't hear any movement in the house. So I opened the door and called out. There was no reply, only a smell that assaulted my nostrils. Pulling a bandana from my pocket, I covered my nose and ventured in. I found Howard lying still in his chair, a viscous discharge dripping from the dressings on his leg. His wife was on the couch across from his chair, slumped over with a syringe in her hand. It was just as Doc predicted. They were too proud to ask for help, and now they had reached their end. No wonder he had left them a bottle of morphine. In this new world, sometimes an option that you normally wouldn't entertain was the only way out for folks in dire straits. The saddest part about standing in Howard's house, looking at his bloated body, was what I was thinking. I had two more graves to dig. It seemed like this was an almost daily routine at this point. But it was getting late, and I wasn't about to start digging in the dark. I left the house. One more day certainly wasn't going to make a difference to them. Once back inside my house, I told Mel I was going to Reggie's house to talk to him for a minute. She asked why, and I told her about Howard. While she was certainly sorry to hear, Mel didn't know them very well, and so the impact was minimal. Just another death. She said she wanted to go to Reggie's too, just to get out of the house, which sounded like a good plan to me. She called the girls inside and told Taylor we'd be back shortly. Taylor asked if she could make popcorn. It was becoming a rare treat. But after witnessing the gruesome events next door, I felt like I wanted to give my girls whatever bit of happiness I could. Leanne wanted to watch a movie, and Little Bit started going through the DVDs. With the girls settled, we headed out. Mel climbed in the Polaris, wrapping her arms around me. As I pulled through the gate, I tooted the horn at Thad and Sarge, who both waved. Jeff was splitting wood by the front door. "Hey, man, where's Reggie?" Jeff pulled his gloves off. "Out back, I think." "Hi, Mel." "Hey, Jeff, thanks for splitting some wood for us." Jeff laughed. "Oh, yeah, no problem. You did bring a hot dinner, right?" I laughed at that one, and we started around the house to find Reggie. He was at the barn, cutting up a palm heart, throwing the pieces to the pigs. "Hey, Morg." He nodded his head toward Mel. "Mel, you trust this clown to drive you around?" "Yeah, I do now. Doesn't happen too often these days," Mel replied.
"I guess not. What's up?"
I told him about Howard and his wife. I didn't even have to tell him we needed to dig graves.
"I'll bring the tractor over in the morning," he said, sighing a bit as he said it.
"Thanks, man. It makes it a lot easier. When are you guys going to start moving stuff?"
"Tomorrow. The old man is making a list of what he wants to take first."
When I asked what kind of stuff was on the list, he laughed and answered,
"Weird shit. PVC pipe, the gabions from the barricade, empty buckets, garden tools, fence, rolls of wire."
The thing that really topped the list was that Sarge wanted him to go around and check every abandoned house for a water filter. And if there was one, he wanted the purple stuff inside it. "Potassium permanganate has lots of uses," I said.
"Like what?" Mel asked me. "Water purification for one, explosives for another."
Reggie laughed.
"Let me guess which one he wants it for. Sounds like a lot of work to me. Guess we're going to be a little busy."
"Yeah, guess so." We said our goodbyes and headed out. Mel said she had wanted to go to Danny and Bobby's house, which was just down the road a bit. When we pulled up, Danny and Bobby were sitting on the porch. They walked out to us, and we chatted across the fence for a while. Neither of the ladies were thrilled at the prospect of having to leave. They understood the logic behind it, but hoped it wouldn't happen. Danny and I agreed with them on both accounts.
Danny said he was going through his seed collection and thinking about trying to start some plants. I didn't have a lot of seeds, but I did have a few stray packs, enough to get a garden going. We'd always planted tomatoes, cucumber, squash, zucchini, green beans, peppers, and onions. Between Danny and me, we should be able to put a decent garden. Mel suggested we use the egg crates we keep on top of the fridge to start the seeds in. We could set them out in front of the sliding glass door to give them plenty of light and keep them from the cold. We left them and headed back home. The difference in the neighborhood between now and 6 months ago was very apparent. It was now a virtual ghost town. Riding back toward home, none of the houses had any sign of life. All the houses seem empty. Where is everyone? Mel asked over my shoulder. I guess they all left. I know some of them went to that camp at the old bombing range. Maybe all of them did. She didn't say anything else, just tightened her grip around me. As we approached our gate, I could see Sarge and Thad down at the barricade. Mel asked to be let off so she could start dinner, and after she hopped off, I headed down to see them. "What's up?" I asked, as I coasted to a stop. Sarge leaned back and said, "We need to figure out who's going to relieve us. We've got to keep this thing manned." "I could come back later. Danny would probably come, too." "Sounds good. You and him be here at 20-100. I'll have some of the boys relieve you guys later tonight. Keep your eyes open, bring your NVGs, and keep an eye out. Them bastards are probably going to try something soon enough." "You think so?" I asked.
"I think we need to plan on it," Thad added.
"If they do, we need to be ready. Go tell Danny to stop by Reggie's place to pick up some radios I've got. We'll keep one here from now on. If anything happens, whoever is here will call for help, and we'll come a-running," Sarge said.
"Sounds good to me. I'll go tell him. We can charge the radios at my place," I replied.
"Good. On that note, you need to start thinking about what it's going to take to get that solar power system moved. We'll need it at the new location."
I hadn't even thought about this yet.
It wouldn't be physically hard, but it was a kind of psychological hurdle. By taking it down and moving it, it meant that moving was a permanent deal.
"Also, gotta bring your rig down to Danny's in the morning so we can load up his stuff first. Got a lot of things we can use," Sarge said.
"Sure thing, no problem." I looked over at Thad, who was quieter than usual today. He was fishing around his backpack and pulled out something. Sarge leaned over and asked, "What you got there, Thad?" Without looking up, he answered,
"It was my boys." He pulled out a transformer.
Sarge stiffened. "I'm sorry, buddy. I'm not going to tell you I know how you feel, because I don't. In my line of work, a family's a hard thing to have. I didn't want to leave a wife and kid behind if anything ever happened to me."
Thad rubbed his thumbs over the toy, then looked over at Sarge. "It ain't no easier the other way around."
I really felt for him. I couldn't imagine it, losing my family in front of my eyes. I remembered how often he had spoken of his wife and son on our walk home. But what could I say? There just aren't words for some things. I patted Thad on the back. "I'll see you guys in the morning," I said.
Chapter 3 Jess lay on her bunk, trying to sleep. Mary had given up her attempts at conversation, but other women kept chatting. After counting sheep, counting backward, and counting the cracks in the ceiling, Jess knew that she wasn't going to be able to fall asleep. So she got up and headed to the door, feeling restless. As she stepped outside, she was met by a security officer, who looked at her sternly and said,
"We're locked down. You have to go back inside."
Jess reached into her pocket and handed the man a little slip of paper that allowed her to visit her brother. He looked at it and appeared unsure what to do.
I don't know. You're supposed to be locked down."
"I'm going to the infirmary. It's not like I can go anywhere else." The man looked at the paper again, then back at her.
"Your brother?"
"Yeah.
He's been in there since we got here. Taking another look at the paper, he handed it back.
Go ahead.
She thanked him, stuffing the paper into her pocket as she walked away. She took her time, just enjoying the freedom of movement, but not straying from her course, as that would certainly bring trouble. There was still a lot of activity in the camp, though she couldn't identify what the DHS officers were doing. When she reached the infirmary, the usual orderly was sitting at the little table inside. Recognizing her, he quickly waved her through. Jess walked down the ward to her brother's bed and sat in the chair beside it.
Hey, it's me. How are you today?
There was no response. Jess looked him over and grabbed his hand.
Some of the bandages are gone. You must be getting better. Before you know it, you'll be out of here.
She looked at her brother's face. And then what are they going to make you do? She thought. She lifted the blanket to look at the wound on his stomach, the worst of the visible wounds. The bandage looked fresh, though there was already fluid coming through it. She lifted his hand to her face and kissed it, seeing all the little cuts and scratches. His fingernails were still dirty. At least they could have cleaned them, she thought, before looking down at her own nails. I could use a manicure too. A little laugh escaped her. She stayed there for a few more minutes, just watching him rest.
I know you need your sleep. I'll see you tomorrow.
Jess laid his hand on the bed and left, returning to her tent. Mary was up when she got back.
Enjoy your nap?
Jess asked, as she flopped down on her bunk.
Yeah, I'm just bored to death.
Jess looked around the tent.
I know, this place is starting to get to me.
I'm about ready to get the hell out of here.
Me too. I don't think they'll just let us stroll out the gate, though.
Me neither. Jess let out a sigh. I wonder what we're doing tomorrow.
I hope it isn't firewood again. I'm sick of that saw. They work us like damn slaves.
I know. We came here by choice, and I don't mind doing my part, but it's a little ridiculous. Cutting wood, filling sandbags, doing all this work.
She paused and thought. It reminds me of some of the stories from my history class about prisoners of war and what they were made to do.
Line up for inspection, line up for meals, line up for roll call.
Ugh. I didn't think about being like a prisoner, but I do feel like I'm in grade school again, Mary said.
Jess looked at her.
Yeah, they treat us like children, incapable of doing anything for ourselves.
She stared off into the distance.
I never thought of that till now.
It's almost as if they want us totally dependent on them.
Jess was zoning out for a few minutes when a loud voice interrupted her thoughts.
Hey, what do you think all the shooting was about?
A woman two bunks down from Jess asked her bunkmate.
I don't know. It reminded me of everything we just left, her friend replied.
Well, at least there's food here, the first woman said.
Well, that's true. Have you seen anyone else from the neighborhood?
I have, the first woman said. I saw Mark.
A cot squeaked as the woman shot up.
Did he see you? Did you talk to him?
We did. He asked what tent we were in. He said he would drop in and check on us.
Jess closed her eyes, trying to sleep, as the two women continued on about this Mark fellow.
And, as if by magic, a few minutes later, there was a quick knock at the door, and a uniformed man entered.
Unlike the other agents that performed security functions and wore black uniforms with the Department of Homeland Security patch, this man wore a green uniform with a gold sheriff's star on his chest. The women beamed as he approached.
Mark!
The man sat down at the foot of her bunk.
How are you guys? When did you come in?
A couple of days ago. We finally got assigned to this tent. It's actually kind of nice, one of them said.
The man smiled.
Yeah, we're trying to keep things together as best we can.
What was all that shooting about earlier? Is that why we're locked down?
Yeah, some trouble outside the fence. Everything's all right, though. You ladies don't have to worry.
The man paused for a moment.
Was there anyone still in the neighborhood when you guys left?
The
The only people we saw were Morgan and his bunch, the first woman said.
Yeah, and he's brought other people into the neighborhood.
They're staying in Pat's house, the second woman said.
When Jess heard Morgan's name, her eyes opened wide.
Could it possibly be him? She thought.
That damn Reggie is with them, and some huge black guy I've never seen before. But what really bothers me is that Danny and his wife threw in with Morgan,
the first woman said.
I know. I can't believe Danny would do that. He's such a nice guy.
Morgan has always been a pain in the ass, the second woman said.
Well, we'll be paying Morgan a visit soon enough. We have to disarm him and his friends, Mark said.
Now Jess was sure they were talking about the same Morgan. To know that she was so close to them, knowing that they were in trouble, filled her with a profound feeling of dread.
Do you think he had anything to do with the shooting outside the fence? The second woman asked.
I doubt it. Whoever was doing all that shooting had automatic weapons, and I seriously doubt Morgan has that kind of hardware, Mark said.
Well, something needs to be done about him. I heard he shot Pat and her family for no reason.
Jess watched and didn't see any reaction from the man in response to the woman's statement. But she felt she knew Morgan well enough that if he'd shot somebody, there was a reason behind it. The fact that these women believed that Morgan would act in cold blood rubbed her the wrong way. Before he left, Mark told the women that he was keeping them off of the worst work detail. In a hushed tone, the man went on to explain that the camp was situated on a bombing range and that one work detail involved the removal of an unexploded ordnance. There was one bomb disposal unit at the camp that consisted of three men, and they could not do all the work alone. So the most undesirable refugees were being used to perform this dangerous task. He told them there had already been fatalities, but it had to be done so the camp could expand and take in more refugees. After the man left the tent, Jess rolled onto her back, her mind racing. A strange feeling of exhilaration ran through her. Morgan and Thad and Sarge were so close, but she knew it was impossible to escape with the camp security being as tight as it was. However, she knew in her heart that she couldn't stay. Jess looked over at Mary, who was napping in her bed. She knew that Mary would certainly want to get out if the chance ever arose, and decided she would tell her about Morgan the next morning. Jess finally drifted off to sleep with a little assurance that hope still existed.
Chapter 4. At precisely 2000 hours, Danny and I were at the barricade. Danny had stopped by Reggie's house and picked up the radio. One radio would be kept at the barricade at all times now, and Sarge and his boys would have the other one with them down at Reggie's house. If anything happened, we would call them, and they would be ready to respond to any event. Danny told me that they would be relieved around midnight. It was a quiet and clear night, and kind of boring, to be honest. From time to time, Danny or I would take the night vision goggles and look up and down the road, but we didn't see anything. Across the road from the barricade, heading due west, was an open field, separated from the road by a barbed wire fence. The pasture is about 60 or 70 acres of hay. On the other side of the hay field sat a house, and all my times at the barricade, the house always appeared unoccupied, just as it did this night. It was just something else to look at, out in the darkness, besides the road and the fence. There was no foot traffic on the road, no people, no vehicle traffic of any kind. At one point, off in the distance, three or four shots rang out, echoing out into the darkness. We both listened for a minute to see if there would be a reply, but there was nothing. At midnight, Jeff and Ted came driving up to the barricade and one of the buggies, leaving it in the brush, because as we had discussed before, it was a bad idea for anyone to see one of these things now. We were not sure if the DHS folks had gotten a look at them during the firefight, so it was better to be safe than sorry.
You guys are relief? Danny asked.
Yeah, we drew the short straw, Ted said as he stretched. Let the old man know that we have to dig a grave in the morning before we come down, I said, heading for the ATV.
Really? Who?
Jeff asked.
Old man Howard and his wife.
Jeff looked stunned.
Both of them? How?
They OD'd. I assume she gave him a shot, then one to herself.
A shot of what? Ted asked.
Morphine. Doc left it with them. He was in pretty bad shape. They couldn't keep his wounds clean.
Damn it. He should have known better than to leave that shit with them, Ted said.
In the faint moonlight, I could see that he was shaking his head.
I think he did it on purpose.
He kind of said so.
I guess I can see it. With that leg, he was certain to get an infection. Probably a better way to go than from waiting for it to rot off.
Yeah, I guess. Well, we'll see you guys tomorrow.
Take it easy, fellers.
Danny and I climbed onto our machines and headed home for a few hours of sleep, leaving Jeff and Ted to keep an eye on things. The next morning, I woke up at 5. The good old days of sleeping in till 9 were long gone for me. Mel was still asleep, and I didn't bother waking her. After strapping on my hardware, I went out on the porch and waited for Reggie. I heard the tractor in the still morning air long before I saw it. Danny was on his Polaris behind the tractor as the two of them passed my driveway, heading for Howard's. Danny stopped beside me.
What up?
More burying, I replied.
Yeah. Getting a little old, huh?
Getting a lot old, brother. Let's go get it done. Reggie was already at work on a hole when we joined him. Danny and I got ready to go inside to retrieve the bodies. Pausing at the door, I pulled a couple of pairs of latex gloves out of my pocket and handed a pair to Danny. He took them and looked at me.
Is it that bad?
Yeah, it's pretty nasty. The smell inside was worse than I recalled, beyond disgusting. I pulled out one of the bandanas and tied it around my face, trying to filter some of the stench. Both Howard and his wife were in rough shape. A puddle of discharge from Howard's leg stained the carpet in a thick pool. He was already a big man and was now starting to swell. It was a major job to get his body out of the chair and onto a sheet spread on the floor. Lifting the ends of the sheet, we skidded the body toward the door. Thankfully, Reggie had pulled the tractor up, and he had the bucket sitting on the porch. Howard's wife was a small woman, but the way she fell on the sofa had her body in an awkward position, and rigor had set in. We finally got her onto the sheet and were able to carry her out the door and set her in the bucket. As Reggie drove to the hole with the bodies, Danny and I sat on the porch. We needed a break. We weren't talking, just sitting there in silence, when Danny suddenly reached back and slammed the door shut. He was shaking his head with a look of disgust on his face.
"I can't stand that smell. This is fucking horrible," Danny said.
"I know, man. I'd never imagined it could get like this."
"We took so much for granted," Danny said with a sigh.
Then a little smile split his lips, and he looked over.
"Life used to be so easy. We looked forward to the weekend, maybe a little fishing or some time in the river in the kayaks."
He trailed off, and then looked back at the house.
"We're gonna have to burn this place. Can you imagine what it'll be like in the summer? Just a breeding ground for disease."
I hadn't thought of that, but he was right. We walked over to Reggie to tell him the plan.
"At least that's done," he said.
"Not quite," Danny said. Reggie looked at him uncertainly.
"Are you telling me that there's someone else in there?"
"No, but we've got to do something about the house. It's pretty bad in there," I said. Reggie looked from Danny to me.
"What do you guys want to do?"
"Burn it," Danny said. Reggie was surprised by the statement.
"You really think we need to do that?
If we leave it like it is, it will get really bad when it warms up, spreading disease and who knows what," Danny said. Reggie thought about it for a minute.
"Couldn't we just pull out the furniture and stuff?"
"You need to go take a look," Danny said. Reggie ambled over to the house and seconds later came out coughing, holding a hand over his mouth. After catching his breath, he said,
"You're right. We can't leave it like this.
I saw a kerosene lantern in there. Still has fuel in it. We could use it to light it," I said. It didn't take long for the flames to spread from the sofa where I poured the fuel and lit it. We stood back watching as the flames grew in intensity. In just a couple of minutes, the entire mobile home was a roaring fireball, with thick black smoke rising up into the sky. Almost about the same time, several ATVs came flying up the drive. Sarge and a couple of the guys were looking at the house, then at us.
"What the hell happened?"
Sarge asked as he walked up.
"We burned it," Danny said.
Sarge looked back at the house, then back to us.
"Why? Thought you were going to bury him."
"We did," I said, pointing to the gravesite. "We burned it to keep disease from spreading."
"Was it that bad?" Mike asked.
"Yeah, it was worse than bad," Reggie said.
"It was a smart move. I'm sure there was a lot of body fluids and all.
It would have gotten really bad once it warmed up," Doc said.
"All right, then, it's done. Now, fellas, we got work to do," Sarge said. "There's a lot to move, more than you probably think."
"With all that strange shit you want, there is," Reggie joked.
"You'll thank me later, I assure you."
"Yeah, those cabins were rather sparse. Getting them up to speed to live in is going to take some effort," Danny said.
"You guys think I wanted a bunch of stuff? Well, I bet your ladies are going to come up with all kinds of stuff they need," Sarge said. "Just wait. You'll see."
Chapter 5. The next morning, Jess and Mary were going through the breakfast line when Jess whispered in Mary's ear,
"I've got something to tell you."
Mary turned her head and mouthed a silent shh. But she had a look in her eye like she knew that Jess was up to something. They had to be careful with everything they said. The security staff were extremely paranoid. Anyone heard talking about anything that could be construed as a violation of the security of the camp would be immediately placed in the detention side of the camp. Once they had their plates, the two moved off to one of the tables that sat end to end, running the length of the mess tent. As soon as they sat down, Jess jumped right into it. Looking from side to side, Jess leaned forward and whispered,
"Mary, you won't believe this. Remember those guys I told you about, Morgan and Thad?"
Shoving a spoonful of grits into her mouth, Mary nodded her head eagerly.
"I heard someone here talking about them yesterday.
They're around here somewhere." Jess was getting more excited. Mary looked from side to side, then leaned in.
"Really? I thought Thad lived in Tampa."
"That's where he was going, but I heard them talking about Morgan and some big black guy. It has to be him." Mary smiled.
"Is he cute?"
The question caught Jess off